To be here. It's great to have a church together this morning. As you may know, we're studying through Genesis this year as a church, and I'm going to be in Genesis chapter 1 this morning, so you can turn over there if you'd like to, which would be a good idea, because that's what we're going to be reading. Genesis is an interesting book, especially Genesis chapter 1. It's an interesting topic to handle, and what I'm going to be sharing today is going to be a little bit different to what I'm normally doing. I'm going to be answering kind of some of the common questions that come up when we read this book. We're going to look at some of the possible challenges here. I know even amongst Christendom, there are many views of Genesis as well, and we're going to look at a few different ones of those. But this is all part as well of our theme this year, which is by faith. All right? Our theme this year is by faith. And for all of us, obviously, our goal is to increase our faith, is to grow in our faith, or possibly even develop a faith. Maybe you're here and you're searching or questioning or not sure what this is all about, and this is a great place to be. But I want to share a little joke with you first, okay? Airline passengers watched nervously as two men wearing pilot uniforms and dark glasses, using canes to feel their way around, fumbled their way into the cockpit. Minutes later, the plane starts barreling down the runway, and the passengers begin to get scared as the water at the end of the airstrip nears. And with only a few yards left, everybody starts screaming. But the plane lifts off just in time, and the passengers soon begin laughing in relief, assuming it was all a joke. "You know," says one pilot to another, "one day they're going to scream too late, and we're all going to die." Two blind pilots flying this plane, everybody on there is freaking out. They rely only on the screams of their passengers to fly their plane. I share this because it's funny, but I think sometimes people can think faith operates in this way. That faith is blind. And that we just kind of take leaps into something just because, I don't know, for whatever reason, right? You just choose to believe in a God, or you just, you know, choose mystically to believe in the Bible for whatever reason. I don't believe that to be true in any way, shape, or form. And I believe that we can make very reasonable, very educated decisions on why we think something is true. And as we read Genesis, and as we aim to grow in our faith this year, I think that's especially important. Because when we have faith, faith is not having faith in faith itself. Okay, it's not some hyped up, amped up confidence just for the sake of it. And I've been in those points before. And I've been to points where I've been like, I've just got to believe hard enough. And I will really work myself up to believe. But that's not what faith is. You know, faith comes from hearing the word. It comes from hearing the message. Faith comes from being rooted in the knowledge and in the evidence and in the truth that we have at our fingertips. And what I'm going to be sharing this morning is a few thoughts on some of that, and especially starting in Genesis. And this morning, I hope really will answer two big questions in the human heart. How are we here and why are we here? How did we get here to where we are and why? How did God create the world, and why did God create the world? And we're going to look at those two things this morning. So if you want to pick up with me in Genesis chapter 1, and we'll start reading there. "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, 'Let there be light.' And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, 'Let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water.' So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above it. And it was so. And God called the expanse sky, and there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, 'Let the water under the sky be gathered into one place, and let dry ground appear.' And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, 'Let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds.' And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seeds according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night. And let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights, the great light to govern the day and the lesser night to govern the sky. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, let the water teem with living creatures and the birds, and let the birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky. So God created the creatures of the sea and every living and moving thing with which the water teems according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the waters in the seas and let the birds increase on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creatures that move along the ground and wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. You with me so far? Fantastic. Verse 26. This is where we come in. Then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created him. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increasing number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruits with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. This is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created, when the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. Amen. We'll stop there for our reading. So God creates the world. He creates everything in it, all its vast array. He puts it all together. And we hear this account here in Genesis. Now, some of the challenges we have is, how do we read this? It talks about 7 days. It talks about it being created on 6 days, and then the seven is rested. And do we read those as 7 literal days, as 7 24-hour periods? Do we read this as more kind of poetic? Is this meant to be literal? How is it meant to be read? I think actually in some ways there's different views on this. Even in Christendom, there's different ways people tend to read it and tend to look at it. And honestly, I'm going to leave it up to whatever you decide for you. And I don't think that's necessarily the most important thing as we look into this morning. I will say this. I do not believe that we need to be shackled to the idea that it has to be 24-hour periods. I believe there are some challenges even in the text if we shackle ourselves to that. Some Christians do believe that, and that's totally fine. And if that's what they want to do, I don't think it needs to be read like that. I think when we think about, is this account compatible with evolution, which is a big thing in our day as well. I don't see them as directly conflicting. I don't believe that anything in the text here means you absolutely cannot ever believe in evolution and read the Bible at the same time. I believe this is a false argument where science against religion, against the Bible has been created. And I believe it just distracts us from really what is most important. There's absolutely no reason God could have used evolution as the tool to bring us about. I don't believe there's any reason that can't be true according to the text. I think when we think of it, when it reads day and you look into the wording, you look to Hebrew, it's the Hebrew word yom. That in other periods is used to describe that is ages and times and periods. So there's no reason that it needs to be 7 24-hour periods. In fact, you only really get the sun and the moon later on anyway. It creates problems, but I think it can be either. I think it can be ages and periods. There's no real reason. But this isn't the things we need to be arguing about. And this is the young earth theory, right? Because a lot of people will say, you believe the earth is only 5,000 years old. However, I will say this. I believe in an incredibly powerful God. And absolutely, God have created the world in 6 seconds if he wanted to. In theory, God have created the world yesterday and made all of you with all your memories and experiences just pop into existence yesterday. And you don't actually, we don't know that's not true. We're not sure. We just believe from the Bible it happened probably longer ago than that, okay? God's very powerful. He could have done those things. And it's totally up to him however he does it. Here's some things we definitely agree on, all right? Number one, that God created the universe. He was in charge. He was the one that brought it all about. That God created it in love. His motive, his purpose, his meaning behind it was love. That he created it good. It wasn't broken, wasn't damaged, wasn't like the kind of stuff I make. It was really good, and he did it really well. That humans are made in God's image. And because of that, we are different from the rest of creation in that respect. And that we were created to rule under God as his representatives, a role which later on we'll see in Genesis 3 and 4, we rejected in our pride and our rebellion, deciding to choose to exalt ourselves above God. We all agree on those points. And there, what's really important. And that's what gives the meaning and the value about what we do. But I want to share a few considerations for us today. All right. Firstly, why was Genesis written? Anytime you read a book in the Bible, you've got to understand what was the context, why was it written? Okay, and who by? It was written by Moses. And I can tell you for sure, Moses wasn't there when God was creating the world. Okay, that's for sure. Okay, Moses is kind of, us didn't even appear to about day six. So, Moses wasn't there, but we believe obviously there was knowledge passed down through the Israelites. And also, what I absolutely believe, there was divine inspiration given to Moses to write what he wrote. And we're going to explain why we believe that in a little bit more as well. But written by Moses, basically why? To root Israel in God. To explain who are you, where have you come from, and why is it important for you to be worshipping the God that we worship? And what kind of a God is he? Because we learn a lot, even reading Genesis, about what kind of a God that we worship. And I'll share a few other creation accounts which show kind of different views of God as well. How it's written. Again, I've already alluded to this, but a lot of the Bible, there's so many different types of writing in the Bible. There's poetic writing. There's wisdom literature. There is historic literature, which we are meant to take factual in this year, this king at this time. And like I said, there's more poetry in different points. And however you read Genesis, I think it can be read as poetry. Okay, so a few examples of why I think it possibly could be read as poetry. When you look at Hebrew 1:1, we're a little bit technical, so stay with me, all right? The first two verses, and when you look at the Hebrew words, there's seven Hebrew words in Genesis 1:1. Genesis 1:2, there's 14 Hebrew words. There's this repetition of seven throughout the whole of Genesis. Okay, when you look at the whole creation account in Genesis as well, the word God appears 35 times. How many sevens is that? 5 7. We're very good. This is awesome. All right, 5 7s there. The word earth appears 21 times. The word heaven appears 21 times. 3 7s. It was good or it was so is constantly repeated. It's repeated 7 times. We see this repetition like a stanza, like a poem is written. And another reason as well, this is quite fascinating. When you look at the parallel between days 1 to 3 and days 4 to 6, okay, so days 1 to 3, think of it, they create like a space. And days 4 to 6 creates the thing that has dominion over that space. Okay, it creates light, heaven and earth. Day 4, the sun and the moon, which have dominion over that space. In day 2, it's water and sky. In day 5, the birds in the air, the birds and the fish. Right, we have dominion over those there. Land and plants in day 3. Day 6, animals and man. Do you understand? This is parallel. It's this repetition. That's why a lot of people believe this is more poetic meaning and more poetic language. Does that change truth in any way? No. It doesn't change truth. It just changes how we read it. And it gives us to read it intelligently when we do. All right. I'll share some helpful considerations, but I want to answer a question here. When I read this, one of the things that puzzled me, God creates light on day 1. But you don't see the sun until day 4. Have you ever thought about that? That's kind of strange. All right, there are many ways that can easily be explained. Number one, maybe the light in day 1, what's the current scientific explanation? The Big Bang. One huge burst of light which created everything out of nowhere. Maybe that light in day 1 is literally the Big Bang, and our actual sun didn't appear till day 4. Perhaps it's more like this. Perhaps it is more a repetition than a poetry. Another way is the Hebrew writers. One thing you notice when we read there, it doesn't name the sun or the moon. It didn't call it sun, it didn't call it moon, it didn't give it names. It just said there was a greater light and a lesser light. Reason being, the Hebrews, I think, wanted to separate themselves from the idol worship of their day. Where the other thought of the peoples at those times, well, the sun and moon were gods, and they would worship them. Which shows just how advanced the civilization, the Israelites really were. And they were distancing themselves from that. I think there are many plausible explanations of why that can be true. Another one I found interesting as well was maybe that it's talking about day four. Light, you can only perceive light with eyes. And it was only later on that with animals and creation that they could actually perceive the light anyway. It was another thing. I don't know. I think it's very interesting. But a few helpful considerations for us, all right? I think a few possible faith builders or even just things I'm going to give you for you can possibly look into. Firstly, science hasn't disproved God, which is so important for us to remember. And nor is there this absolute contrast between them. Okay, science gives explanation on how things work. It's not an alternative to what the Bible explains. Again, in fact, what I'll show in a minute is actually the Bible is incredibly authoritative when it comes to being backed by science, which I will explain a little bit more. But science didn't disprove God, nor can it, nor ever will. Okay, and the argument of you can't see God and you can't it is absolute rubbish, because there is much things we believe in that we can't see. Plenty of things. We understand how light particles work. We understand how gravity works. We understand how wind works. You all believe you have a brain, I hope, and inside organs. We all believe in emotions, and we believe in experience, feeling. You can't see any of these things. The argument you can't see something and there it's not true is just nonsense. Okay, if you have zero reason to believe anything, then I think that is a what the kind of faith I ridiculed when I was a non-believer. But we have incredible, great reasons to believe in a God and believe in the God of the Bible as well. And I think that's what's important. And previous scientific understanding has evolved, so to speak. Okay, we know this. Scientists used to believe that the Earth was flat. That was a commonly believed opinion before. And even until a relatively recent history, they would have believed that there was no beginning. There was no point when the Earth actually started. They would have believed that it always just existed for all time. That was the current scientific explanation. And this guy, Lemaître, who was actually a priest as well as a physicist, first kind of introduced the idea of the Big Bang. And the idea that there was actually a beginning, which was a surprise to the scientific community, but not a surprise to Christians who had the Bible all along, which explained there was a very beginning. You have the Genesis Enigma, which was really, really interesting. And this is a book by Andrew Parker. In the Genesis Enigma, respected evolutionary biologist Andrew Parker explains each parallel between Genesis and science in detail. And the closer he looks, the more amazing the parallels become between the days of creation as explained in Genesis and our current scientific understanding of how we got here. It matches perfectly in parallels, which is incredible. But the Genesis account has no right to be correct, Andrew Parker says. They didn't have access to that kind of information. The author or authors could not have known these things happened in this order with the highlights science has come to recognize. And he actually concludes, non-believer, but he concludes, they must have had some kind of divine inspiration. There's not another explanation of how it came to be. Other accounts of how we came to be. Other accounts are, the only similar one is a Babylonian account at the time. The only similarities are that it's written on 7 tablets, roughly represents similarly the days. But from that, it's wildly different. How we're created is by wars between gods and one god killing another and from his blood creating humans. Creating humans not because of out of love, but because they wanted to live a luxurious lifestyle and needed us as slaves. That's probably the most closest account of the current times. And probably some of the worst is that the world was carried around on giant animals floating out in space. So these are comparable accounts for similar peoples at the times, which is important for us to realize. Jesus and the apostles accepted Genesis is true. All throughout the New Testament is quoted. They quoted it to talk about marriage. They quoted it to talk about culture. There's so many different things. They took it as true. How they read it is different, but they definitely took it as true. And you've got to ask yourself the question, which explains it better? Okay, all that science does is explains it. I think people lean on science as a crutch, as they might say that we do for God, to excuse, I don't have to believe in God. I don't want to believe in God. I can find other explanations. Being able to explain something doesn't remove God from the picture. Theory number one, there was nothing. Absolutely nothing. There was a big bang. In the first 3 minutes, 90% of all known elements were formed. Amoeba, fish, animals, primates, humans, natural selections, evolution. There's no design. There's no meaning. It's all happen chance. That's theory number one. Everything explodes out of nothing. Theory number two, There's too many coincidences for this not to be design. The angle of the Earth's tilt, distance from the sun, distance between stars, composition of atmosphere. There were so many thousands of details. If they were slightly off, life would not be possible. The conscience that we have, that we sacrifice for each other, that we are able to love, that many of our best qualities that we value in society can't be put down simply to survival skills of evolution of the fitness. It doesn't add up completely. And lastly, that a brilliant, loving God designed us. That's theory number two. Both, true, plausible, possibly, but which more explains our experience? Which more explains what we see around us? I have a few points for us to consider. Firstly, at heart of everything is a God of love. When we look at the creation account, and we look at what God did and how he made it, at the heart of everything is a God who loves us, a God who cherishes us, a God who created the world so that we can know him and experience him. Everything he did was good. Every motive was love. Every purpose for us as well as love. That's incredibly encouraging. That's good news. That is awesome. We don't serve a tyrannical dictatorial God. We don't serve a distant and aloof God. It's a God that engages. It's a God that connects. This gives purpose. This gives meaning to our lives. The alternative, that there is absolutely no God, the hopelessness, meaninglessness, our lives have zero purpose whatsoever, that's a hopeless way to live. And absolutely not true and completely false. But there is a truly loving God at the heart of all of this, the heart of why we are here today. The second is that Jesus was there at the beginning. Turn over to John chapter 1. And I think John chapter 1 intentionally parallels these verses. In John chapter 1, it reads, in verse 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. In verse 14, it says, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Jesus was not an afterthought. Okay, God preempted the end at the beginning. Jesus was there from the beginning. Everything was created through him. Everything was created for him. He is at the center of everything we do. He did not come into existence when he came into the earth as flesh. He had always existed. But he made a decision to lower himself and engage with us, to reconnect us with God. Because as we go through Genesis, we're going to see these themes play out. The theme of our continual sin, our continual rebellion, our continual turning away from God. Even from the very beginning of taking the fruit, our rebellion against God, us wanting to define good and evil by ourselves and eliminate God from the picture, to exalt our own selves. And that is the consistent pattern of human history. It is what people do, and we drift astray. And I know for many of us, we even see that in our own hearts, in our own natures. But again, it's so encouraging to know God always had a plan. God always had a plan for us. God always had a plan to rescue us and to love us. But he still gave us every opportunity to get it right the first time. Jesus was there at the beginning. And finally, the end is better than the beginning. In 1 Corinthians 15, 42. Says this. It says, so will it be with the resurrection of the dead. The body that is sown is perishable. It is raised imperishable. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. It is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body. You know, I share this because what waits ahead of us is better than what happened at the beginning. You see, when Jesus returns and recreates a new heaven and a new earth, it's not a return to Eden. It's even better. It's even greater. The hope that lays ahead of us, the hope of heaven, the hope of complete connection with God for the rest of eternity. Eternity won't even exist. Time won't even exist. We'll be God for literally forever. What awaits us in incredible hope, incredible purpose, incredible meaning, incredible connection. with an incredibly loving God who has done everything to rescue us and save us. These earthly tents we live in will be remade into new heavenly tents, which is good news. I'm only 27, but I'm already starting to feel things. I'm like, oh my goodness. I'm looking forward to a resurrection body. I'm looking forward to heaven. But we have that hope ahead of us. And it's a hope that we don't need to believe whimsically. It's a hope we don't need to believe against evidence. It's a hope we don't just blindly leap into. We can very reasonably, based on evidence, based on truth, based on everything that God has done, He has given us every possible opportunity and explanation, we can turn to Him and trust Him and know Him and take that decision of faith. It's not blindness, it's trust. It's trusting that God is a loving God. I want to close with this quote from C.S. Lewis. You know, the Christian says, creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exist. A baby feels hunger, well, there is such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim, well, there's such a thing as water. And if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing. And if that is so, I must take care, on the one hand, never to despise or to be unthankful for these earthly blessings, and on the other, never to mistake them for the something else of which they are only a kind of copy or echo or mirage. I must keep alive in myself the desire for my true country, which I shall not find till after death. I must never let it get snowed under or turned aside. I must make it the main object of life, to press on to that country and to help others to do the same. We simply are not made for this world. This world was made for us. We have another world, we have another home, and that's where we're heading. And when we think of Genesis and we think of all this stuff we've looked at and all this creation, honestly, let it fill our minds with wonder. A God of purpose, a God of love is at the heart of all of these things. Jesus was there at the beginning. His plan for our redemption and us able to turn for Him was there at the beginning. And we're invited to share in that great purpose and that great meaning and turn to Him and know Him as He truly is. Amen.
You know, it's great to hear a lesson every so often where we examine just some of the current scientific theories and comparisons to the Bible. And for me, I love hearing stuff like that just because my background is based in science. And for me, the more I studied the medical sciences at university, the more I was convinced of the fact that God is the one who made us. I'm currently reading a book by a fellow by the name of John Lennox, who's a professor at Oxford University. The book I'm reading is entitled 7 Days That Divide the World. And it's a fantastic book, and I would highly recommend it to anyone with a scientific interest. John Lennox is he's an incredibly intelligent fella. he got his doctorate from Cambridge University. He's got numerous degrees, and now he teaches maths and science and religion at Oxford. But he's often seen debating people like Dawkins and others, just with regards to, you know, the fact that we can trust the Bible, but it's fascinating, and just the way that he has such a strong conviction, the fact that it's God who created the world. And I would encourage all of us just to really to have open hearts, that not be taken in by the stuff you hear in society, but rather to actually take time to examine and explore the evidence for yourself. Thank you, Jack, for a really inspiring message this morning. Can I at this time ask Lola and Renata Vlaun to come forward?